warriors assembled at the village square, dressed in their uniforms, carrying their weapons and ammunition in backpacks and waist belts. Their bayonets hung by the side of their army trousers, and they stood still with their helmets under their arms. "Attention! At ease! Attention! At ease!" I heard the voice of the drill instructor as I walked to the river with Elijah to fetch water. When we returned, the drill instructor had stopped warming up the soldiers. Instead, Lieutenant Jabati stood in front of his men, his hands crossed behind his back. He addressed them for hours before they were released for lunch. While the lieutenant was talking to his men, we quietly went about our daily chores and at the same time tried to eavesdrop on what he was saying. But in order to hear him, we would have had to get closer and join the line of soldiers, which was out of the question. We walked about all day, quietly speculating about what the lieutenant could have told his men. In the evening, the soldiers cleaned their guns, sometimes firing a couple of rounds into the air. These random gunshots sent the younger children diving between the legs of their parents. The soldiers smoked cigarettes and marijuana. Some sat alone, while others gambled and joked with one another into the night. Some watched a movie under one of their big tents. Lieutenant Jabati sat on the veranda of his house and read a book. He would not look up, not even when his men whistled loudly at the size and sophistication of a gun in the war movie they were watching. He looked up only when it was quiet. He caught me looking at him and called me to sit with him. He was a tall man with barely any hair. His eyes were big and they complemented his full cheekbones, which looked as if he had something in his mouth. He was a quiet individual, but his quietness had a forceful authority that all his men feared and respected. His face was so dark that it took courage to have any eye contact with him. "Are you getting enough to eat here?" he asked. "Yes," I said, as I tried to look at what he was reading. "It is Shakespeare," he showed me the cover. "Julius Caesar. Have you heard of it?" "I read Julius Caesar in school," I told him. "Do you remember any of it?" he asked. "Cowards die many times before their deaths," I began. And he recited the whole speech with me. As soon as we were done, his face resumed its sternness. He ignored me and seemed to delve into his book. I watched as the veins on his forehead became transparent through his flesh and disappeared as he absorbed the contents of the book or thought about whatever else was on his mind. I tiptoed away from him as the sky exchanged sunlight for darkness. When I was 7, I used to go to the town square to recite monologues from the works of Shakespeare for the adults of my community. At the end of every week, the male adults would gather to discuss matters of the community. They sat on long wooden benches, and at the end of their discussion, I would be called upon to recite Shakespeare. My father would cough loudly to alert the other adults to be silent so that I could start. He sat in the front with his arms crossed and a big smile on his face that looked as if it would take years to fade away. I stood on a bench and held onto a long stick as my sword. I would then start with Julius Caesar. "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears." I always recited speeches from Macbeth and Julius Caesar, as those were the adults' favorites. I was always eager and excited to read for them because it made me feel that I was really good at speaking the English language. I was awake when the soldiers left in the middle of the night, the echo of their marching leaving an eerie air about the village that continued until dawn and through the rest of the day. There were 10 soldiers left behind to protect the village, and they stood at their posts all day, just when the evening was waving its fingers, signaling night to approach. The soldiers issued a curfew by shooting a few rounds into the air and ordering everyone to get inside and stay low to the ground. That night, Musa told no stories and Moriba didn't play marbles with the other boys. We quietly sat against the wall listening to the rapid burst of gunfire in the distance. Just before the last hours of night, the moon sailed through the clouds, showing its face through the open window of the building before it was driven away by a cockcrow. That morning didn't come just with sunrise. It brought with it soldiers, the few who were able to make it back to the village. Their well-polished boots were drenched in dirt, and they sat away from each other, clinging tightly to their guns, as if those were the only things that comforted them. One soldier who sat on a cement brick underneath the kitchen bowed his head in his hands and rocked his body. He got up and walked around the village and returned to sit on the brick again. He did this over and over throughout the day. Lieutenant Jabati was on the radio, and at some point he threw it against the wall and walked into his room. We civilians didn't speak among ourselves during that day. We only watched the madness unfold in some of the soldiers. At midday, a group of 20 soldiers arrived in the village. The lieutenant was surprised and delighted when he saw them, but he quickly hid his emotions. The soldiers prepared themselves and left for war. There was nothing to hide anymore. We knew the war was near. Soon after the soldiers left, we began hearing gunshots closer to the village. The soldiers who guarded the village ordered everyone inside. The gunfight went on into the evening, interrupting the songs of birds and the chants of crickets. At night, soldiers came running to the village for ammunition and a quick respite. Wounded soldiers were brought back only to die by lamp-lit surgery. The soldiers never brought back their dead colleagues. Prisoners were lined up and shot in the head. These things went on for many days, and each time the soldiers went to the front lines, few returned. Those left behind became restless and started shooting civilians who were on their way to latrines at night. The lieutenant asked his men to gather everyone at the square. In the forest, there are men waiting to destroy all of our lives. We have fought them as best as we can, but there are too many of them. They are all around the village. The lieutenant made a circle in the air with his hands. They won't give up until they capture this village. They want our food and ammunition. He paused and slowly continued. Some of you are here because they have killed your parents or families, others because this is a safe place to be. Well, it is not that safe anymore. That is why we need strong men and boys to help us fight these guys, so that we can keep this village safe. If you do not want to fight or help, that is fine, but you will not have rations and will not stay in this village. You are free to leave because we only want people here who can help cook, prepare ammunition, and fight. There are enough women to run the kitchen, so we need the help of able boys and men to fight these rebels. This is your time to avenge the deaths of your families and to make sure more children do not lose their families. He took a deep breath. Tomorrow morning, you must all line up here, and we will select people for various tasks that have to be carried out. He left the square, followed by his men. We stood in silence for a while and slowly started walking to our respective sleeping places as the curfew was approaching. Inside, Juma, Alhaji Kene, Moriba, Musa, and I quietly discussed what we were going to do. The rebels will kill anyone from this village because they will consider us their enemy, spies, or that we have sided with the other side of the war. That is what the staff sergeant said, Alhaji said, explaining the dilemma we faced. The rest of the boys, who were lying on the mats, got up and joined us as Alhaji continued. It is better to stay here for now, he sighed. We had no choice. Leaving the village was as good as being dead. Attention! This is an order from the lieutenant. Everyone must gather at the square immediately. A soldier spoke into a megaphone. Before he had finished his last word, the square was filled. Everyone had waited for this moment that would determine what we were going to do for our safety. Before the announcement, I sat with my friends near the window in the kitchen. Their faces were blank. They showed no emotion, but their eyes looked pale with sorrow. I tried to make eye contact with each of them, but they all looked away. I tried to eat my breakfast, but fear had taken away my appetite. As we found spots in the back of the crowd, gunshots filled the air and then faded to a silence even more unbearable than the reports. The lieutenant stood on several bricks so that he could be high enough to be seen by all. He let silence settle in our bones, then waved his hands to some soldiers who brought before us two bodies, a man and a young boy who had lived in the village. The blood that soaked their clothes was still fresh, and their eyes were open. People turned their heads away, and little children and babies began to cry. The lieutenant cleared his throat and started speaking in the midst of the cries, which eventually ceased as he went on. I am sorry to show you these gruesome bodies, especially with your children present. But then again, all of us here have seen death, or even shaken hands with it. He turned to the bodies and continued softly, "This man and this child decided to leave this morning, even though I had told them it was dangerous. The man insisted that he didn't want to be a part of our war, so I gave him his wish and let him go. Look at what happened. The rebels shot them in the clearing. My men brought them back, and I decided to show you, so that you can fully understand the situation we are in." The lieutenant went on for almost an hour, describing how rebels had cut off the heads of some people's family members and made them watch, burned entire villages along with their inhabitants, forced sons to have intercourse with their mothers, hacked newly born babies in half because they cried too much, cut open pregnant women's stomachs, took the babies out and killed them. The lieutenant spat on the ground and continued on, until he was sure that he had mentioned all the ways the rebels had hurt every person in the gathering. "They have lost everything that makes them human. They do not deserve to live. That is why we must kill every single one of them. Think of it as destroying a great evil. It is the highest service you can perform for your country." The lieutenant pulled out his pistol and fired two shots into the air. People began shouting, "We must kill them all. We must make sure they never walk this earth again." All of us hated the rebels, and we were more than determined to stop them from capturing the village. Everyone's face had begun to sadden and grow tense. The aura in the village rapidly changed after the speech. The morning sun had disappeared and the day became gloomy. It seemed as if the sky were going to break and fall on the earth. I was furious and afraid, and so were my friends. Juma looked toward the forest. With his hands behind his back, Moriba was holding his head. Kene stared at the ground. Musa wrapped his hands around himself. Alhaji covered his eyes with his left hand, and I stood akimbo to stop my legs from shaking. All women and girls were asked to report to the kitchen, men and boys to the ammunition depot, where the soldiers watched their war movies and smoked marijuana. As we walked toward the building, a soldier who carried a G3 weapon came out and stood at the doorway. He smiled at us, lifted his gun, and fired several rounds toward the sky. We dropped to the ground, and he laughed at us as he went back inside. We walked through the door and came upon the tents inside the building. The building was roofless, except for the tarpaulin that covered the boxes of ammunition and guns stacked against the wall. And in the only common space, a huge television screen sat on top of a dilapidated drum. A few meters away from the television stood a generator, along with gallons of gasoline. The soldiers came out of their tents as the staff sergeant led us to the back of the house, where none of us had been before. There were more than 30 boys, two of whom, Sheku and Josiah, were 7 and 11 years old. The rest of us were between the ages of 13 and 16, except Kene, who was now 17. A soldier wearing civilian clothes, with a whistle around his neck, stepped up to a rack of AK-47s and handed one to each of us. When the soldier stood in front of me, I avoided eye contact, so he straightened my head until my eyes met his. He gave me the gun. I held it in my trembling hand. He then added the magazine, and I shook even more. "It seems that all of you have two things in common," the soldier said after he had finished testing all of us. "You are afraid of looking a man in the eye and afraid of holding a gun. Your hands tremble as if the gun is pointed at your head." He walked up and down the line for a bit and continued, "This gun," he held the AK-47 high up, "will soon belong to you, so you better learn not to be afraid of it. That is all for today." That night, I stood at the entrance of my tent for a while, hoping my friends would come out to talk, but no one did. Alhaji stepped out and looked in my direction for a few minutes, but he then turned and just stared at the ground. I was about to walk toward him when he re-entered his tent. I inhaled the cool night breeze, which brought with it the scent of marijuana. I sighed, went back into my tent, and sat on the top all night, unable to sleep. I just sat with my head in my hands, thoughtless. It was the first night that I was awake alone without having a migraine. As I began to ponder why this was the case, a cock started crowing. though it was still dark outside. The confused cock crowed throughout the night until morning finally arrived. My two tent companions, Sheku and Josiah, the two youngest boys, were still sleeping when the bell rang at 6 a.m. for us to rise for training. "Come on, let's go," I tried to wake them up with a gentle shake. They just rolled over their sides and continued sleeping. I had to drag them off the mat by their legs and slap them until they woke up. The soldiers were already going from tent to tent, dragging out those who were still asleep and splashing buckets of water on them. We met at the training ground, and new crepes were distributed, along with army shorts and t-shirts that were of all colors. Some people got Adidas and others Nikes. I got a black Reebok pump and was happier about my new crepe than anything else that was going on. I took off my old pants, which contained the rap cassettes. As I was putting on my new army shorts, a soldier took my old pants and threw them into a blazing fire that had been set to burn our old belongings. I ran toward the fire, but the cassettes had already started to melt. Tears formed in my eyes, and my lips shook as I turned away. After we had put on the new attire, we formed a horizontal line with legs apart and hands straight down at our sides. As we stood waiting, some of the soldiers returned from the front line and reloaded their guns and side packs with ammunition. Some had blood on their uniforms and faces, which they didn't seem to notice or simply ignored. They quickly ate breakfast and were on their way back to where they didn't look as if they wanted to return. Each soldier stood against the wall, took several deep breaths with his eyes closed, and gripped his gun tightly before beginning to run back toward the clearing. Sheku and Josiah stood next to me as if sharing a tent with them meant that I had become their big brother. They watched me during the exercise and followed what I did instead of the soldier who had introduced himself as Corporal Gaddafi. He was a young fellow, younger than the lieutenant and the staff sergeant, but was bald and his countenance made him look much older. He had an intense face that looked, even smiling, as if he were chewing something sour. First, we ran around the building for a few minutes and then we began to learn how to crawl in the bushes nearby. Corporal Gaddafi would hold his fist up, and when he brought it down, we fell into the bushes and crawled quickly, without producing much sound, until we reached a designated tree. Then we immediately got up and crouched to take cover behind other trees. Afterward, we would run back to the training ground. The corporal didn't say much during the initial stage of training. All he said was, "Not bad, terrible, and faster." He mostly used hand gestures, which he said was the only thing that would be used once we were out there. He would point to the clearing where words could cost you a bullet in the head. He would then smile dryly and widen his eyes for us to laugh with him. After we had done the running, crawling, and crouching many times, we were allowed to have some bread and custard. The corporal gave us 1 minute to get the food and eat it. Whatever we hadn't eaten was taken away at the end of 60 seconds. None of us was able to finish eating on the first day, but within a week, we could eat any food in a minute. It was the only part of the training that we mastered. After the late breakfast, we lined up facing the corporal, who handed us AK-47s. When it was my turn, he looked at me intensely as if he was trying to tell me that he was giving me something worth cherishing. He poked my chest with his finger and walked around me. When he came back to the front, he stared at me some more, his red eyes and dark face twitching. He bared his teeth, as if he were preparing to attack, and my legs began to shake when he started to smile. Before I could smile with him, he had stopped, and the veins on his forehead stood up. Still looking straight at me, he reached into a wooden crate and pulled out the gun. He took out the magazine and handed me the AK with two hands. I hesitated for a bit, but he pushed the gun against my chest. With trembling hands, I took the gun, saluted him, and ran to the back of the line, still holding the gun, but afraid to look at it. I had never held the gun that long before, and it frightened me. The closest thing to it had been a toy gun made of bamboo when I was 7. My playmates and I carved them and played war games in the coffee farms and unfinished buildings at my grandmother's village. "Pow, pow," we would go, and whoever did it first would announce to the rest whom he had killed. We continued the training exercise we had been doing earlier in the morning, but this time we carried with us AK-47s that didn't contain any ammunition. We crawled with the guns on our backs, in our hands, and ran around the building with them. The guns were a little heavy for Shaco and Josiah, who kept dropping them and picking them up as we went along. We broke for a minute lunch and began a different drill. We were taken to a nearby banana farm, where we practiced stabbing the banana trees with bayonets. Visualize the banana tree as the enemy, the rebels who killed your parents, your family, and those who are responsible for everything that has happened to you, the corporal screamed. Is that how you stab someone who killed your family? He asked. This is how I would do it. He took out his bayonet and started shouting and stabbing the banana tree. I first stabbed him in the stomach, then the neck, then his heart, and I will cut it out, show it to him, and then pluck his eyes out. Remember, he probably killed your parents worse. Continue. He wiped his knife with the banana leaves. When he said this, we all got angry and drove our knives in and out of the banana trees until they fell to the ground. Good, he said, nodding and pondering something that made him smile longer than usual. Over and over in our training, he would say that same sentence. Visualize the enemy, the rebels who killed your parents, your family, and those who are responsible for everything that has happened to you. That afternoon, we learned how to put the magazine into the gun and other such basics. Ignore the safety pin, they said. It will only slow you down. That evening, we learned to fire our guns, aiming at plywood boards mounted in the branches of tiny trees at the edge of the forest. Shaku and Josiah weren't strong enough to raise their weapons, so the corporal gave them each a high stool to keep the weapons from falling. At the end of the shooting exercise, we were taught how to dismantle our guns and oil them, because the AKs were so old that they would misfire randomly, and sometimes would stop working altogether. That night, as soon as we got under the tent, my tent companions passed out. Instead of smiling in their sleep, Shaku went, pow, pow, boom. And Josiah went, 1, 2, the numbers we had recited as we stabbed the banana trees. But even though I was exhausted, I couldn't sleep. My ears rang with the gun sounds. My body ached and my index finger was sore. There had been no time to think all day, but now I could. I could become angry. Yes, begin to visualize scenarios of shooting or stabbing a rebel. The rebels are responsible for everything that has happened to you. I imagined capturing several rebels at once, locking them inside a house, sprinkling gasoline on it, and tossing a match. We watch it burn, and I laugh. I was distracted by the humming of a boy named Lansana. He was 3 tents down from me, and he sometimes hummed melodies of songs I had never heard until he fell asleep. He started doing this after our first shooting exercise. His voice would echo in the dark forest, and whenever he stopped, the night got quieter.
Chapter 13. It must have been a Sunday morning when the corporal told us to take the day off training. He tapped the palm of his hand with the flat edge of his bayonet. If you are religious, I mean a Christian, worship your Lord today, because you might not have another chance. Dismissed. We went to the square, wearing our army shirts and crepes that had been given to us. We started a soccer game, and as we played, the lieutenant came out to sit on the veranda of his house. We stopped the game and saluted him. Carry on with the game. Right now I want to see my soldiers play soccer. He sat on the stoop and began reading Julius Caesar. When we were done with soccer, we decided to go to the river for a swim. It was a sunny day, and as we ran down to the river, I felt the cool breeze drying the sweat on my body. We played swimming games for a few minutes, then divided into 2 teams for an ambush game. The first group to capture all the members of the other group would win. Let's go, soldiers, the holiday is over, the corporal called out from the banks of the river. We stopped our plane and followed him to the village. As we jogged to catch up with him, we jokingly tripped and pushed each other into the bushes. At the village, we were asked to quickly service our AK-47s. As we cleaned our guns, backpacks and waist packs were distributed among us. Two crates of ammunition were set out, one containing loaded magazines to order loose bullets. The corporal commanded us to take as much ammunition as we could carry. "Don't take too much, though. We want you to be able to run fast," he said. As I loaded my backpack and waist pack, I looked up and saw that some of the older soldiers were doing the same. My hand began to shake and my heart beat faster. All the other boys except for Alaji were having fun because they thought they were gearing up for more drills. But I knew we weren't going for training. And Alaji leaned on the wall of the building, clutching his gun like a mother would hold her baby. He knew it too. "Stand up on your feet, soldiers," the corporal said. He had left us briefly to change. He was fully dressed in army uniform and carried a backpack and a waist bag full of ammunition. He held a G3 weapon and his helmet under his arms. We stood in line for inspection. All of the boys wore army shorts and green t-shirts. The corporal handed us green head ties and said, "If you see anyone without a head tie of this color or a helmet like mine, shoot him." He screamed the last two words. Now it was clear to all that we weren't going for training. As we tied our head cloths, Sheku, standing next to me, fell backward. He had taken too much ammunition. The corporal emptied some of the magazines from his backpack and stood him up. Sheku's forehead was sweating and his lips trembled. The corporal patted him on the head and continued talking. "The other men," he pointed to the older soldiers, "will carry spare boxes of ammunition, so do not overload yourselves. Now relax, we will be on our way in a few minutes." The corporal walked away. We sat down on the ground and everyone seemed to wander into their own thoughts. The daily bird songs were gone, replaced now by the raising of firing levers as the older soldiers readied themselves. Sheku and Josiah sat next to me, their eyes watery and dull. All I could do was rub their heads to assure them it might be okay. I got up and walked over to Alaji and the rest of my friends. We made a pact that no matter what, we would try and stay together. A young soldier came by with a plastic bag full of some kind of tablets. They looked like capsules, but they were plain white. He handed them to each of us with a cup of water. "The corporal said it will boost your energy," the soldier announced with a secretive smile on his face. As soon as we had taken the tablets, it was time to leave. The adult soldiers led the way. Some carried ammunition boxes, the length of two cement bricks, between them, and others had semi-automatic machine guns and RPGs. I held my AK-47 with my right hand, its mouth pointing to the ground. I had attached an extra magazine with adhesive tape to the one inside the gun. I had my bayonet on my left hip and some magazines and loose bullets in my side pack. In my backpack, I had more magazines and loose bullets. Josiah and Sheku dragged the tip of their guns as they still weren't strong enough to carry them and the guns were taller than they were. We were supposed to come back that evening, so we carried no food or water. "There are a lot of streams in the forest," the lieutenant had said, walking away, leaving the corporal to finish what he had started. "It is better to carry more ammunition than food and water, because with more ammo, we will be able to find water and food. But with more water and food, we will not make it to the end of the day," the corporal explained. The women and older people in the village stood on their verandas and watched as we were led away by the adult soldiers into the clearing toward the forest. A baby cried uncontrollably in his mother's arms as if he knew what lay ahead of us. The sun's brightness painted our shadows on the ground. I have never been so afraid to go anywhere in my life as I was that day. Even the scuttle of a lizard frightened my entire being. A slight breeze blew and it went through my brain with a sharp swoop that made me grit my teeth in pain. Tears had begun to form in my eyes, but I struggled to hide them and grip my gun for comfort. We walked into the arms of the forest, holding our guns as if they were the only thing that gave us strength. We exhaled quietly, afraid that our own breathing could cause our death. The lieutenant led the line that I was in. He raised his fist in the air and we stopped moving. Then he slowly brought it down and we sat on one hill, our eyes surveying the forest. I wanted to turn around to see my friends' faces, but I couldn't. We began to move swiftly among the bushes until we came to the edge of a swamp, where we formed an ambush, aiming our guns into the swamp. We lay flat on our stomachs and waited. I was lying next to Josiah. Then there was Sheku and an adult soldier between myself, Juma, and Musa. I looked around to see if I could catch their eyes, but they were concentrated on the invisible target in the swamp. The top of my eyes began to ache and the pain slowly rose up to my head. My ears became warm and tears were running down my cheeks, even though I wasn't crying. The veins on my arms stood out and I could feel them pulsating as if they had begun to breathe of their own accord. We waited in the quiet as hunters do, our fingers gently caressing the triggers. The silence tormented me. The short trees in the swamp began to shake as the rebels made their way through them. They weren't yet visible, but the lieutenant had passed the word down through a whisper that was relayed like a domino effect. Fire on my command. As we watched, a group of men dressed in civilian clothes emerged from under the tiny bushes. They waved their hands and more fighters came out. Some were boys as young as we were. They sat together in line, waving their hands, planning a strategy. The lieutenant ordered an RPG to be fired, but the commander of the rebels heard it as it whooshed its way out of the forest. Retreat, he told his men, and the grenade's blast got only a few men, whose split bodies flew in the air. The explosion was followed by an exchange of fire from both sides. I lay there with my gun pointed in front of me, unable to shoot. My index finger had become numb. The forest had begun to spin. I felt as if the ground had turned upside down and I was going to fall off. So I clutched the base of a tree with one hand. I couldn't think, but I could hear the sounds of the guns far away in the distance and the cries of people dying in pain. I had begun to fall into some sort of nightmare. A splash of blood hit my face. In my reverie, I had opened my mouth a bit, so I tasted some of the blood. As I spat it out and wiped it off my face, I saw the soldier it had come from. Blood poured out of the bullet holes in him like water rushing through newly opened tributaries. His eyes were wide open. He still held his gun. My eyes were fixed on him when I heard Josiah scream. He cried for his mother in the most painfully piercing voice that I had ever heard. It vibrated inside my head to the point that I felt my brain had shaken loose from its anchor. The sun showed flashes of the tips of guns and bullets traveling toward us. Bodies had begun to pile on top of each other near a short palm tree, where fronds dripped blood. I searched for Josiah. An RPG had tossed his tiny body off the ground, and he had landed on a tree stump. He wiggled his legs as his cry gradually came to an end. There was blood everywhere. It seemed as if bullets were falling into the forest from all angles. I crawled to Josiah and looked into his eyes. There were tears in them, and his lips were shaking, but he could not speak. As I watched him, the water in his eyes was replaced with blood that quickly turned his brown eyes into red. He reached for my shoulder as if he wanted to hold it and pull himself up. But midway, he stopped moving. The gunshots faded in my head, and it was as if my heart had stopped and the whole world had come to a standstill. I covered his eyes with my fingers and pulled him from the tree stump. His backbone had been shattered. I placed him flat on the ground and picked up my gun. I did not realize that I had stood up to take Josiah off the tree stump. I felt someone tugging at my foot. It was the corporal. He was saying something that I couldn't understand. His mouth moved and he looked terrified. He pulled me down, and as I hit the ground, I felt my brain shaking in my skull again, and my deafness disappeared. "Get down," he was screaming. "Shoot," he said, as he crawled away from me to resume his position. As I looked to where he lay, my eyes caught Musa, whose head was covered with blood. His hands looked too relaxed. I turned toward the swamp where there were gunmen running, trying to cross over. My face, my hands, my shirt, and gun were covered with blood. I raised my gun and pulled the trigger, and I killed a man. Suddenly, as if someone was shooting them inside my brain, all the massacres I had seen since the day I was touched by war began flashing in my head. Every time I stopped shooting to change magazines and saw my two young lifeless friends, I angrily pointed my gun into the swamp and killed more people. I shot everything that moved until we were ordered to retreat because we needed another strategy. We took the guns and ammunition off the bodies of my friends and left them there in the forest, which had taken on a life of its own, as if it had trapped the souls that had departed from the dead. The branches of the trees looked as if they were holding hands and bowing their heads in prayer. We crouched into the forest and formed another ambush a few meters away from our initial position. Once again we waited. It was between evening and nighttime. One lonely cricket tried to start singing, but none of its companions joined in, so it stopped to let silence bring night. I lay next to the corporal, whose eyes were redder than normal. He ignored my stare. We heard footsteps on the dried grasses and immediately took aim. A group of gunmen and boys emerged from under the bushes, crouched, and took quick cover behind trees. As they got closer, we opened fire, dropping those who stood in front. The rest we chased into the swamp where we lost them. There, crabs had already begun feasting on the eyes of the dead. Limbs and fragmented skulls lay on top of the bog, and the water in the swamp had been replaced by blood. We flipped the bodies over and took their ammunition and guns. I was not afraid of these lifeless bodies. I despised them and kicked them to flip them. I found a G3, some ammunition, and a handgun that the corporal kept for himself. I noticed that most of the dead gunmen and boys wore lots of jewelry on their necks and wrists. Some even wore more than 5 gold watches on one wrist. One boy, whose uncombed hair was now soaked with blood, wore a Tupac Shakur t-shirt that said, "All eyes on me." We lost a few adult soldiers on our side and my friends, Musa and Josiah. Musa the storyteller was gone. There was no one around to tell our stories and make us laugh at times when we needed it. And Josiah, if only I had let him continue sleeping on the first day of training, perhaps he wouldn't have gone to the front line in the first place. We arrived in the village with nightfall and sat against the walls of the army house. It was quiet, and as if we were afraid of silence, we began cleaning the blood off our guns and the ones we had brought with us, cleaning and oiling their chambers. We shot the weapons into the air to test their effectiveness. I went for supper that night, but I was unable to eat. I only drank water and felt nothing. As I walked back to my tent, I stumbled into a cement wall. My knee bled, but I didn't feel a thing. I lay on my back in the tent with my AK-47 on my chest and the G3 I had brought with me leaning on the peg of the tent. Nothing happened in my head. It was void, and I stared at the roof of the tent until I was miraculously able to doze off. I had a dream that I was picking up Josiah from the tree stump, and a gunman stood on top of me. He placed his gun on my forehead. I immediately woke up from my dream and began shooting inside the tent until the 30 rounds in the magazine were finished. The corporal and the lieutenant came in afterward and took me outside. I was sweating, and they threw water on my face and gave me a few more of the white capsules. I stayed up all night and couldn't sleep for a week. We went out 2 more times that week, and I had no problem shooting my gun. Chapter 14. The sharp aches in my head, or what I later came to know as migraines, stopped as my daily activities were replaced with more soldierly things. In the daytime, instead of playing soccer in the village square, I took turns at guarding posts around the village, smoking marijuana and sniffing brown, cocaine mixed with gunpowder, which was always spread out on the table, and of course taking more of the white capsules, as I had become addicted to them. They gave me a lot of energy. The first time I took all these drugs at the same time, I began to perspire so much that I took off all my clothes. My body shook, my sight became blurred, and I lost my hearing for several minutes. I walked around the village aimlessly as I felt restless because I simultaneously felt a tremendous rush of energy and numbness. But after several doses of these drugs, all I felt was numbness to everything and so much energy that I couldn't sleep for weeks. We watched movies at night, war movies, Rambo First Blood, Rambo 2, Commando, and so on, with the aid of a generator or sometimes a car battery. We all wanted to be like Rambo. We couldn't wait to implement his techniques. When we ran out of food, drugs, ammunition, and gasoline to watch war films, we raided rebel camps in towns, villages, and forests. We also attacked civilian villages to capture recruits and whatever else we could find. We have good news from our informants. We are moving out in 5 minutes to kill some rebels and take their supplies, which really belong to us, the lieutenant would announce. His face evinced confidence. His smiles disappeared before they were completed. We tied our heads with the green cloths that distinguish us from the rebels, and we boys led the way. There were no maps and no questions asked. We were simply told to follow the path until we received instruction on what to do next. We walked for long hours and stopped only to eat sardines and corned beef with gari, sniff cocaine, brown, and take some white capsules. The combination of these drugs gave us a lot of energy and made us fierce. The idea of death didn't cross my mind at all, and killing had become as easy as drinking water. My mind had not only snapped during the first killing, it had also stopped making remorseful records, or so it seemed. After we ate and did drugs, we would guard the perimeter while the adults rested for a bit. I shared a post with Alhaji, and we would time each other on how fast we could take out a magazine and replace it. Sometime I am going to take on a whole village by myself, just like Rambo, Alhaji told me, smiling at the new goal he had set for himself. I'd like to have some bazookas of my own, like the ones in Commando. That would be beautiful, I said, and we laughed. Before we got to a rebel camp, we would deviate from the path and walk inside the forest. Once the camp was in sight, we would surround it and wait for the lieutenant's command. The rebels roamed about. Some sat against walls, dozing off, and others, boys as young as we, stood at guard posts, passing around marijuana. Whenever I looked at rebels during raids, I got angrier because they looked like the rebels who played cards in the ruins of the village where I had lost my family. So when the lieutenant gave orders, I shot as many as I could, but I didn't feel better. After every gunfight, we would enter the rebel camp, killing those we had wounded. We would then search the houses and gather gallons of gasoline, enormous amounts of marijuana and cocaine, bales of clothes, crepes, watches, rice, dried fish, salt, gari, and many other things. We rounded up the civilians, men, women, boys, and young girls, hiding in the huts and houses, and made them carry our loot back to the base. On one of these raids, we had captured a few rebels after a long gunfight and a lot of civilian casualties. We undressed the prisoners and tied them until their chests were tight as drums. "Where did you get all this ammunition from?" the corporal asked one of the prisoners, a man with an almost dreadlocked beard. He spat at the corporal's face, and the corporal immediately shot him in the head at close range. He fell onto the ground and blood slowly leaked out of his head. We cheered in admiration of the corporal's fierceness and saluted him as he walked by. Suddenly, Lansana, one of the boys, was shot in the chest and head by a rebel hiding in the bushes. We dispersed around the village in search of the shooter. When the young muscular rebel was captured, the lieutenant slit his neck with his bayonet. The rebel ran up and down the village before he fell to the ground and stopped moving. We cheered again, raising our guns in the air, shouting and whistling. "If anyone starts any funny business, shoot him," the lieutenant eyed the prisoners. We set the thatch roofs on fire and left, taking the prisoners with us. The flames on the thatch roofs waved us off as they danced with the afternoon breeze, swaying as if in agony. "We," the lieutenant pointed to us, "are here to protect you and will do all we can to make sure nothing happens to you," he pointed to the civilians. "Our job is a serious one, and we have the most capable soldiers who will do anything to defend this country. We are not like the rebels. those riffraffs who kill people for no reason. We kill them for the good and betterment of this country. So respect all these men. He pointed to us again, for offering their services. The lieutenant went on and on with his speech, which was a combination of instilling in the civilians that we were doing what was right and boosting the morale of his men, including us, the boys. I stood there holding my gun and felt special because I was part of something that took me seriously and I was not running from anyone anymore. I had my gun now, and as the corporal always said, this gun is your source of power in these times. It will protect you and provide you all you need if you know how to use it well. I cannot remember what prompted the lieutenant to make this speech. A lot of things were done with no reason or explanation. Sometimes we were asked to leave for a war in the middle of a movie. We would come back hours later after killing many people and continue the movie as if we had just returned from intermission. We were always either at the front lines, watching a war movie or doing drugs. There was no time to be alone or to think. When we conversed with each other, we talked only about the war movies or how impressed we were with the way either the lieutenant, the corporal, or one of us had killed someone. It was as if nothing else existed outside our reality. The morning after the lieutenant's speech, we proceeded to practice killing the prisoners the way the lieutenant had done it. There were 5 prisoners and many eager participants, so the corporal chose a few of us. He picked Kenny, 3 other boys, and me for the killing exhibition. The 5 men were lined up in front of us on the training ground with their hands tied. We were supposed to slice their throats on the corporal's command. The person whose prisoner died quickest would win the contest. We had our bayonets out and were supposed to look in the faces of the prisoners as we took them out of this world. I had already begun staring at my prisoner. His face was swollen from the beating he had received, and his eyes looked as if they were watching something behind me. His jaws were the only tense part of his facial expression. Everything else seemed calm. I didn't feel a thing for him, didn't think that much about what I was doing. I just waited for the corporal's order. The prisoner was simply another rebel who was responsible for the death of my family, as I had come to truly believe. The corporal gave the signal with a pistol shot, and I grabbed the man's head and slit his throat in one fluid motion. His Adam's apple made way for the sharp knife, and I turned the bayonet on its zigzag edge as I brought it out. His eyes rolled up and they looked me straight in the eye before they suddenly stopped in a frightful glance, as if caught by surprise. The prisoner leaned his weight on me as he gave out his last breath. I dropped him on the ground and wiped my bayonet on him. I reported to the corporal, who was holding a timer. The bodies of the other prisoners fought in the arms of the other boys, and some continued to shake on the ground for a while. I was proclaimed the winner, and Kenny came second. The boys and the other soldiers who were the audience clapped as if I had just fulfilled one of life's greatest achievements. I was given the rank of junior lieutenant, and Kenny was given junior sergeant. We celebrated that day's achievement with more drugs and more war movies. I had a tent to myself, which I never slept in because sleep never came to me. Sometimes late in the night, the quiet wind brought to my ears the humming of Lansana. It seemed as if the trees whispered the tunes of the songs he had sung. I would listen for a bit and then fire a few rounds into the night, driving the humming away. Chapter 15. The villages that we captured and turned into our bases as we went along and the forest that we slept in became my home. My squad was my family. My gun was my provider and protector, and my rule was to kill or be killed. The extent of my thoughts didn't go much beyond that. We had been fighting for over 2 years, and killing had become a daily activity. I felt no pity for anyone. My childhood had gone by without my knowing, and it seemed as if my heart had frozen. I knew that day and night came and went because of the presence of the moon and the sun. But I had no idea whether it was a Sunday or a Friday. In my head, my life was normal, but everything began to change in the last weeks of January 1996. I was 15. I left one morning with 20 members of my squad for Bauya, a small town a day's walk south of us, to get ammunition. My friends, Alhaji and Kene, came too. We were excited to see Juma, who was now stationed there. We wanted to hear his war stories, hear how many people he had killed. I was also looking forward to seeing the lieutenant. I hoped we might find some time to talk about Shakespeare. We walked in two lines on the sides of a dusty path, looking into the dense bushes with our bloodshot eyes. We arrived at the outskirts of Bauya just before sunset and waited in the bushes as our commander went ahead to make sure our colleagues wouldn't shoot at us. We sat against trees and watched the path. The commander returned after several minutes and motioned for us to move into town. I hoisted my gun on my shoulder and walked next to Kene and Alhaji as we entered the base. The cement houses in the town were bigger than the ones I had seen in other villages, and everywhere we looked were unfamiliar faces. We nodded to acknowledge other soldiers as we walked around town looking for Juma. We found him sitting in a hammock on the veranda of a cement house that faced the forest. There was a semi-automatic machine gun next to him, and he seemed lost in thought. We slowly walked up to him, but before we could scare him, he heard our footsteps and turned toward us. His face seemed to have gotten older, and he had stopped nodding when he spoke. We shook hands with him and examined his gun. "I see that you carry heavy weapons these days," Alhaji joked with him. "Well, what can I say? I am moving up from the AKs," he replied, and we all laughed. We told him that we would return to sit with him in a few minutes and went to load our bags with ammunition and food to take back. While we were in the ammunition house, our commander told us that the lieutenant had asked us to stay the night and that dinner was ready. I wasn't hungry, so I returned by myself to see Juma while Kene and Alhaji went to eat. We sat quietly for a while before he started talking. "I am going on a raid tomorrow morning, so I might not see you before you leave." He paused, fingered the side of the machine gun, and continued. "I killed the owner of this gun in our last raid. He took out a lot of us before I could get him. Since then, I have used it to do some damage myself." He chuckled, and we high-fived each other and laughed. Immediately after that, we were ordered to report for the nightly gathering in the yard at the center of town. It was a social event for commanders to mingle with everyone else. Juma picked up his gun and put his arm around my shoulder as we walked to the yard. Alhaji and Kene were there. They had already started smoking. Lieutenant Jabati was present too, and he was a little jovial that night. Most of his colleagues, Staff Sergeant Mansare and Corporal Gaddafi, had died, but the lieutenant had miraculously managed to stay alive unscarred. He had also been able to replace his dead colleagues with other men who were fierce and disciplined. I wanted to talk to the lieutenant about Shakespeare, but he was busy going about the gathering, shaking everyone's hand. When he finally stood in front of me, he held my hand tight and said, "Macbeth shall never vanquished be until great Bynum Wood to high Dunsinane Hill shall come against him." He nodded at me and said loudly to everyone, "I shall take leave of you fine gentlemen." He bowed and waved as he left. We raised our guns in the air and cheered. After the lieutenant had gone, we began singing the national anthem. "High we exalt thee, realm of the free, great is the love we have for thee." And marching, smoking, and sniffing the cocaine and brown brown that was in abundance at Bauya. We chatted all night, mostly about how good the drugs were. Before morning, Juma and a few others left for their raid. Alhaji, Kene, and I shook hands with him and promised that we would catch up more on our next visit. Juma smiled, clutched his machine gun, and went running into the darkness. A few hours later, a truck came to the village. Four men dressed in clean blue jeans and white t-shirts that said UNICEF on them in big blue letters jumped out. One of them was a white man, and another was also light-skinned, maybe Lebanese. The other two were nationals, one with tribal marks on his cheeks, the
the other with marks on his hands, just like the one my grandfather gave me to protect me from snake bite. The men were all too clean to have been in the war. They were shown to the lieutenant's house. He had been expecting them. As they sat talking on the veranda, we watched them from under the mango tree where we sat cleaning our guns. After a while, the lieutenant shook hands with the two foreigners and he called over the private who was guarding the meeting. The private ran toward us and told us to form a line. He went around the town gathering all the boys, exclaiming, "This is an order from the lieutenant." We were accustomed to taking orders and did what we were told. We formed the horizontal line and waited. The lieutenant stood before us and we saluted him, expecting to hear about our next raid on a rebel camp. "Stand at ease, boys," he said. He slowly walked along the line, the visitors a few paces behind him, smiling. "When I point at you, fall out and form a line by the private. Understand?" The lieutenant gave his orders from the far end of the line. "Yes, sir," we shouted and saluted. The smiles on the visitors' faces disappeared. "At ease." You, the lieutenant pointed as he walked down the line. When the lieutenant picked me, I stared at his face, but he ignored me and continued his selection process. Alhaji was also picked, but Kene was left behind, maybe because he was older. 15 of us were chosen. The lieutenant then ordered us, "Remove your magazines, put your weapons on safety, and put them on the ground." We laid our weapons down, and the visitors, especially the two foreigners, began smiling again. "Attention! Forward march!" a private ordered us, and we followed the lieutenant toward the truck the visitors had arrived in. We stopped when the lieutenant turned around and faced us. "You have been great soldiers, and you all know that you are part of this brotherhood. I am very proud to have served my country with you boys, but your work here is done, and I must send you off. These men will put you in school and find you another life." That was all he said. Then he smiled and walked away, asking the other soldiers to strip us of our military equipment. I hid my bayonet inside my pants and a grenade in my pocket. When one of the soldiers came to search me, I pushed him and told him that if he touched me, I would kill him. He walked away and searched a boy standing next to me instead. What was happening? Our faces followed the lieutenant as he walked to his house. Why had the lieutenant decided to give us up to these civilians? We thought that we were part of the war until the end. The squad had been our family. Now we were being taken away just like that, without any explanation. A few soldiers gathered our weapons, and others guarded us, to make sure that we didn't try to run for our guns. As we were ushered to the truck, I stared back at the veranda where the lieutenant now stood, looking in the other direction, toward the forest, his hands crossed behind his back. I still didn't know what was going on, but I was beginning to get angry, anxious. I hadn't parted with my gun since the day I became a soldier. In the truck were three MPs, city soldiers. I could tell by how clean their uniforms and guns were. Their pants were tucked inside their boots and their shirts were tucked into their pants. Their faces weren't hardened and their guns were so clean I assumed they hadn't fired a shot. The weapons were on safety. The MPs jumped off the truck and motioned for us to climb in. We divided ourselves onto two long benches in the truck that faced each other. And two of the men, the one with the marks on his cheeks and the Lebanese-looking foreigner, climbed in the back with us. Then the three MPs swung up on the back door panel, one foot inside the truck, the other hanging out. As the truck began to pull away from the base, I started boiling with anger because I couldn't make sense of what was happening. Alhaji looked at me with a puzzled face. I looked at the guns the MPs carried and envied them. The men who had come to get us smiled as the truck sped along the dirt road, raising light brown dust that covered the bushes on the sides of the road. I had no idea where we were going. We were on the road for hours. I had gotten used to walking to places and hadn't sat in a truck or been in one place idly for this long in a while. I hated it. I thought about hijacking the truck and driving it back to Bauya. But whenever I was ready to snatch a gun from the MPs, the truck slowed down at a checkpoint and the soldiers jumped off. I had forgotten about the grenade in the side pocket of my army shorts. I was restless throughout the journey and actually began to look forward to the checkpoints. There were many of them, too many, so that I could get up from the boredom of the truck. We didn't speak to each other at all. We sat quietly, except at times when I winked at Alhaji as we waited for the right moment to take the guns from the MPs and push them off the truck. The last checkpoint we passed that day was manned by soldiers well-dressed in complete army gear. The brown polished wooden panels of their AKs were shiny and new. They were city soldiers who, like the MPs who were in the truck with us, hadn't yet been to war. They had no idea, I thought, what was really happening in the bushes in the entire country. We drove past the checkpoint, off the dusty road, and onto a busy tar street. Everywhere I looked, there were cars going in every direction. I had never seen that many cars, trucks, and buses in my life. Mercedes, Toyotas, Mazdas, Chevrolets were impatiently honking, music blasting. I still didn't know where we were going, but I was sure now that we were in Freetown, Sierra Leone's capital, but I didn't know why. It was getting dark outside. As the truck slowly rocked along the busy street, streetlights flickered on. Even the shops and kiosks were lit. I was amazed at how many lights there were without the sound of a generator. I was marveling at the glittering cityscape when the truck turned off the street and began galloping so heavily that we were all shaking as if we had been placed on a vibrating machine. This went on for a few minutes and then we stopped. The MPs asked us to get out of the truck and follow the four beaming men in the UNICEF shirts. We entered a fenced compound that had several rows of houses. There were lights on in the houses, and boys our age, 15 and above, sat on the verandas and stoops. They ignored us, as they too looked baffled about why they were there. The Lebanese-looking foreigner motioned for us to follow him into the house, his face glowing. It was an open hall, and there were two rows of twin-sized beds. He excitedly showed each of us the bed that was going to be ours, and lockers that contained soap, toothpaste, toothbrush, a towel, a clean shirt, and t-shirts. The beds had pillows, clean sheets, and blankets. None of us were as interested in the things he showed us as he seemed to be. "We have a bale of new crepes for you. Tomorrow you will pick your size." He left us in the room and went outside whistling a melody. We just stood there looking at the beds as if we had never seen anything like them. "Come with me to the kitchen for some food," the Sierra Leonean man with the tribal marks said. We followed him past the curious faces of the boys who had arrived before us. Their eyes were as red as ours, and even though they wore civilian clothes, they looked dirty and had intense expressions like us. I could smell the forest on them. In the kitchen, we sat on one side of the long dining table. The man went into a little room at the end of the kitchen, where he hummed a familiar song, dished out rice into many bowls, and brought them out on a tray. We took a bowl each and started eating. He went back into the little room, and by the time he returned to the table with his own bowl of food to eat with us, we had already finished. He was shocked and looked around to see if we had done something else with the food. He pulled himself together, and as he was about to take his first bite, the two happy-faced foreigners walked into the dining room and asked him to come with them. He took his bowl of rice with him and followed the foreigners, who were already walking out of the kitchen. We sat quietly for a minute before Alhaji asked if anyone happened to bring some marijuana or cocaine. One of the boys had some marijuana that we passed around, but it wasn't enough. "Where can we get ourselves some good drugs in this place?" one of the boys asked. As we pondered this question, the man who had brought us to the kitchen returned, bringing with him another group of boys, over 20 of them. "These are the new arrivals," he said to us. Turning to the new boys, he said, "I will bring you some food, and please take your time. There is no need to eat fast." The boys sat on the opposite side of the dining table and ate as fast as we had. The man sniffed the air and asked, "Who was smoking marijuana in here?" But no one paid him any attention, so he sat down and kept quiet. We stared at the new boys and they at us. Alhaji broke the silence.
"Where are you boys from?" he asked. The boys widened their eyes and stared at Elijah as if he had just asked them the wrong question. One of the boys, who looked a little older and had no hair on his head, stood up, clenching his fist. "And who the fuck are you? Do we look like we're here to answer questions for bastard Peking like you?" He leaned across the table and looked down on Elijah. Elijah got up and pushed him. The boy fell, and when he got up, he pulled a bayonet and jumped on the table toward Elijah. All of us stood up, ready to fight. The man screamed, "Stop it, boys," but no one listened to him. I took out my grenade and put my fingers inside the pin. "Do you boys want this to be your last meal, or do you want to answer his question?" I threatened the other boys. "We are from Konol District," the boy who held the bayonet said. "Ah, the diamond area," Elijah said. I was still holding the grenade. "Did you fight in the army or for the rebels?" I sternly asked. "Do I look like a rebel to you?" he said. "I fought for the army. The rebels burned my village and killed my parents, and you look like one of them." "So we all fought on the same side of the war," Elijah said, and we all sat down, still glaring at each other. Upon learning that we had all fought for the so-called army in different parts of the country, we calmed down and talked about what bases we were from. Neither of us had ever heard of the other squad.